So if you are going to be speaking, we just ask that we're going to be kind of wrapping string around us to create those very literal connections between everyone's conversations. So we just ask that you wrap it around yourself or your chair or something like that if you're going to engage in the conversation, as we hope you do. So thank you so much for coming, and let's begin. Hannah would like to begin.
Yeah.
Don't
pass that yard.
Oh, yes.
The circle's a bit bigger than so what we practiced.
So as Brianna mentioned, what united us as a group is that we wanted to investigate what is left of the self at the end of the world. So amongst ourselves, there's kind of a shared tendency of feeling that there is a crisis, that there is a sense of emergency. But this presumption that we share within our group is not shared by everyone, obviously. Whether by disagreement, in conversation, immense disparities in truth. This summer I'm doing research using Twitter on feminism, and so that's a really good way to see just how different people interpret the reality of the world. There's different ideologies, occupations. So with that context, the way that I've been interpreting that question is, how do we engage with those who see our socioeconomic order not as something indicative of the end of the world, not as dystopic, not as something that is oppressive, but rather the end of history? So to quote like Francis Fukuyama, it is a time of triumph. There is no competitors anymore. We have reached the end, and that is capitalism. How do you engage with those thoughts when there's just such a difference in reality? So the text that I brought is David Kaczynski's The Policy Road to Socialism. Shout out AO, because the way that I was introduced to that was through a conversation with him, and also it struck my fancy because I have a background in political science. That's what I'm studying. So there's a lot of like neoliberal institutional jib all of the time. So in David Kaczynski's article, he's arguing that revolution is not simply improbable, but it is in fact impossible in capitalist democracies. So when I think about, that's like something that is hard to hear, right? When you think about the end of the world, there is a sense of revolution. Those are two P's in a very, very important pause. So feeling different areas of crisis, whether that's ecological, political, or social, how can there really be no revolution beyond revolutionary groups? So that starts a sense of anger. That's something to talk about. So Kaczynski, and by the way, might be butchering it a little, but he essentially hypothesizes that it's more likely that we'll face liberal, leftist social programs and sort of utopic welfare through policy reform rather than systemic revolutionary change. For him, this is due to the legitimizing tendencies of democracy, where capitalist countries would sooner grant reform than see systemic change or any sort of revolutionary tendencies. This is also due to the resiliency and ubiquity of capitalism, both in the physical globalized world, but also in subjectivity. Our desires, our social clock as people, that is capitalistic. So in his words, capitalism is not an organism which is tightly intertwined functional parts, but rather it is an ecology that can absorb different seemingly contradictory parts and adjust them over time. So drawing on empirical evidence, both economic and historical, he makes three main arguments. We will never see revolution in a democratic country, a democratic capitalist country, because workers, just like most humans, are risk averse. They would rather bode in the horrors of today than face a future that we don't know. And also, the circumstances that would lend itself towards revolution are maybe conducive for tyranny rather than some sort of transformative democracy. So furthermore, Kaczynski argues, say the revolution does happen. What happens in the interim period? Is it going to be chaos and uncertainty? Will it be violence and war? He concludes that instead we must be thankful for the democratic shell of socialism, that as long as it's slow and it's forthcoming, that it's making our daily lives better, then we should be thankful. So that is the part that really strikes me. Whether by rising temperatures, relentless disease, increasing anti-democratic tendencies and fascism, and the quotidian intergenerational effects of violence, it feels inept, naive, unhistorical, maybe privileged, to assume that there will be a linear trajectory, that there will even be a future to be approved upon. then there's a really long quote that I'm not going to read right now, but you can read it on your sheet. So for us, there is no blueprint. For now, we're theorizing and grappling and trying to see assemblage of alternatives as we engage with the importance of transnational struggle. If there's no revolution that starts within capitalist democracies, then how can we connect our change to those beyond? And also having an intersectional analysis. So in classic humanities fashion, my question only begets more questions that we talked about. Instead of accepting defeat or being disillusioned and paralyzed by hegemony, what are the active plans to make this not the case? How can we make the revolution sustaining, seductive, and strategic amongst ourselves and for those who are still succumbing to Lauren Berlant's cruel optimism? So revolution becomes not an endpoint, but rather it is an active alternative every day. We're creating a little altar today, so that's what I'll add. Jim, not my forte.
We tried to practice this, but the circle was a little bit smaller, so obviously we have better aim, but that's okay. Before I launch into my text, I'm going to offer something to the altar, which is mostly garbage. Yay! And I really hope it doesn't blow away, so if it does, I am sorry. I will think I'll leave most of this in trash form. What drew me to the reading group, and I guess the question that we've been discussing, is I'm very interested in alternative notions of the self. I really want us to question, or at least myself personally question, what it means to be human or not human, to be alive or not alive. A lot of the time, I think the most traditional understanding of this would be like, I am obviously a living human self, but this wine bottle is a not human, not living thing. But like, is it really? And is that really true just because we say it's true? And obviously putting this in the context of trash, mostly, and the ecological crisis. So the book that I brought to read was Vibrant Matter by Jane Bennett. Matter as in anything that is vegetable, mineral, animal, or beyond. And vibrant as in vibrating frequencies, really kind of drawing attention to the aliveness, the activity, the agency that that individual matter has, whether that was initiated by human forces or not. This book specifically really aims to dissolve the boundary between subject and object, which is quite interesting, and so it is why we chose it. In the first chapter, Vibrant Matter, Jane Bennett pays a lot of attention to a pile of trash that I think she saw on a sewer grate and likes to draw attention to the specific singularity of all of that trash in that pile. It is that specific wine bottle, it is that specific Cadbury Dairy Milk wrapper that has made its way there and is still doing its thing even though it's been discarded by human beings. Of this trash, she says, thing power rose from the pile of trash, not flower power, or black power, or girl power, but thing power. The curious ability of inanimate things to animate, to act, to produce effects dramatic and subtle. In other words, ordinary objects and stuff have independence and aliveness outside of human experiences. Even though no one is using that garbage anymore, it's still there garbaging. A lot of this comes through recognizing the agency of things, which is a fundamental concept in vital materialism, the political philosophical field that Bennett works in. Dealing with the post-human, other words, all things matter. Jane Bennett says that we ourselves are vital materiality and that we're surrounded by it, even though we don't always see it that way. In other words, the I is actually a composite of its. Our bodies and idea of self is very porous. We are constantly entering and leaving these assemblages of things. There's also a very long quote, which you can read on your worksheet, hopefully, wherein she talks about how human being is a human power is a kind of thing power. It's very easy for us to acknowledge that we are full of stuff. We are full of mineral in our bloods, in our bones. We have electricity in our neurons, all of this stuff. But it's harder to acknowledge that it's more challenging to conceive of these materials as lively and self-organizing rather than passive or mechanical means of direction under something non-material like an active soul or mind. Or in other words, we are things with things inside of us that also have independence and importance and agency. They aren't just there to make us tick. So from there, I had some questions like, is the self an individual or collective? Is the self a thing? And what does thing power leave out? Does that even matter at the end of the world? Through our conversations as a group, I think we discussed that this, if the self is an assemblage of things like microbes and minerals, ideologies, diets, and more, we recognize the agency of the vibrant matter that we're composed of. A self can never really end. It just transforms by entering and leaving assemblages. We should use this recognition to reshape the self and its interests, to promote greater empathy with who or what might be outside of that, and to foster more responsible transformations within this world as it may or may not be ending. This is obviously applied to the ecological crisis, but also any kind of social or political rupture that we're facing. Basically, rethinking the concept of a self as more than an individual human being with a soul, whatever that means, and the implication that has on a more than human existence in the world. I would say that problems that I think we all had with the reading was that it does preserve some of the false superiority of human beings. She talks a lot about how anthropomorphizing these objects is the best way for us to empathize with them and understand their own agency, which I kind of have a problem with, because it's like, is it really? Or can they just be things on their own? And it also removes other forms of power from the equation. She's very fixated on thing power, but it's like, why not also black power or girl power as well as thing power? What if we unify these powers to get a better understanding of agency and what it means to be outside, as in garbage, but also as in like human life that may be considered disposable? So I will be.
Two texts to the group for my week. They were very unrelated in material, but very related in theme. The first of the two was a text from Crime Think, which is a podcast publication. A zine publication. It was called Terra Incognita. It was did the rounds in the early 2010s. Sorry, my voice is not very loud. It did the rounds in the early 2010s in the time of Occupy. And it is all about liberal notions of consent and how the revolution cannot include all of our consent. So it's going beyond this notion of consent that requires that we live in a consensus reality, so one that everyone agrees to be a part of, that we should go around and have everyone speak their opinion and everyone raise their hand and say, yes, I agree, let's take this action, let's burn down this bank, let's fuck shit up in such or such way. Because there's always going to be more conservative members of a revolutionary party. There's always going to be left-leaning liberals. There's always going to be bankers and landlords that want to essentially retain the status quo, maintain things as they are. We're never going to have a revolution that includes everyone's consent. So they propose a sort of alternative notion of consent, which is all organized around seduction. So the idea of making a movement seductive and bringing things beyond what one could imagine wanting, introducing something to someone, and that is essentially what seduction is. It's introducing something to someone that they didn't know and that they didn't know that they wanted. It's not the kind of thing that you can say, fuck yeah, I'm down, I want this, ask for it in advance. It has to be something that comes to you and that takes over you in a sense and can never be affirmed, can never be joyfully, ecstatically said yes to. And this text relates to the other text which I brought, which was by Avdi Sakatopoulou, a queer theorist and psychoanalyst, whose text is called Risking Sexuality Beyond Consent. It's a very intense text in that it talks a lot about consent and in the sense of non-consent. Her idea of consent is called limit consent, which is also in contrast to this affirmative notion of consent or positive consent that says that actions that happen to you, you should be able to say yes to them in order for them to happen first. So Sakatopoulou, as a psychoanalyst, has an idea of personal development which says that the self is formed around some fundamental traumas. So as a child, when you're brought into an existence, you start recognizing other objects around yourself, you start recognizing other selves as being distinct from yourself. That's why I brought a mirror. The mirror phase is an important phase of psychoanalytic development in which you recognize yourself as being a distinct thing. You are something outside of the objects around you. You are something that is not just self. There's also objects, as Oriana has said, assemblages of organs and features and things that you attribute to yourself. So Sakatapalu reads this movement of coming into selfhood and of viewing objects and seeing them as distinct as necessarily traumatic, because these objects are new objects. They're something that the ego could never know of before. It could never say, yes, I want to be a self. It could never say, yes, I want to see chair and grass and my mother as distinct from me. So all of these things are entered into the self in this traumatic moment of creation of the self. And she proposes that the only things that can really change the structure of selfhood are things that are outside of positive notions of consent. They have to overwhelm. So this idea of overwhelm is things that happen to you at moments of extreme intensity. So erotic moments, moments of revolution, moments of extreme pain, all of these things are things that you can't affirm in advance because you could never know what they will be. And they will always, in a sense, destroy a part of you and create a new you afterwards. I brought a little bit of a text, which was something that I assembled from how these two texts come together, and I also have a few quotations and a few questions, which I would like to ask. I'll start with my thesis. So, in moments of sexual rupture, orgasm, immense pain, it is theorized that the self meets a boundary point, something like the edge of itself. Many of us can attest to this from immediate experience. It is what we feel when bodies meet and no longer feel distinct, when a pain is so immense that the self no longer seems to travel forward through time. I seek to make a connection between this state of self-rupture and that of the revolutionary self. The liberal capitalist self is constituted around the liberal capitalist notions structuring our world. The nation, property ownership, and gender are examples of these. In order to move beyond liberal capitalism into the whatever is next, the revolutionary self must excise itself from these notions until none of the old world is left in the new world. This is not simply a process of elimination and change, but rather of total destruction and, presumably, a reconstitution into the whatever is next, a new self for a new world. The old self, however, could never know in advance what the experience of the new self would be. The old self cannot wholly consent to being destroyed and reconstituted as something entirely new. This is the resistance of left liberals to radical politics. It is the desperation of the landlord, the cop, the politician, keeping this dying world afloat. It is also the cop inside our heads, the concessionist, the reformist. It is the fear of what we will lose jumping into the unknown. The future is beyond consent, and it cannot exist. And I believe you have my questions on your sheet, and these are all just questions that we have that we would like to open up as a discussion now and later, that everyone can join into.
And we can start.
Okay. So, I can start.
Hi.
Oh, right. I forgot where you were here. Okay. So, what I was thinking about, because I feel like when we talk about the world, like, we're kind of talking about, like, capital T, capital W, you know? I think that what I've really kind of, like, understood is that there are many world-makings happening, but I guess sort of what capitalism, colonialism tries to claim is that there's one unified world, you know, running under this rhythm of progress, like, that we're all contained in this world. Similarly, I feel like the self under neoliberalism is also illusioned as a sort of containment, you know, that there's this, like, autonomous, unified self that can, like, be a subject within this, like, rhythm of progress, you know. And for the kind of, like, world that we live in to exist, that being right now, here and now, capitalism, colonization, neoliberalism, there also needs to be the specific notion of the autonomous self, you know.
And so I think with your readings and what I was really thinking about a lot was kind of this idea how I think what that reading specifically does really well is it really kind of like moves at the edges of the self and kind of tears apart the ways in which there's so much otherness within us already. Even the way that you're talking about like bacteria on our skin, bacteria in our body, things, there's so much of ourselves. The majority of ourselves is not ourselves, you know? And I think that it really kind of like points to these illusions. And I feel like, especially when right now we're moving towards an end, I feel like that's where I'm always most interested in like entering into it, because I feel like there's always I don't know, I think that tearing apart this notion of an autonomous self is a part of it, you know.
I definitely agree. I don't know what else to say other than that I agree with that entirely, which is why I was very interested in my reading.
Oh
yes, you should try that and we'll tie this over here.
Is anyone who's not of the group, have you written down anything as you were speaking? Do any of the quotes speak to you?
Yeah, I'm really interested in hearing them. Yeah.
Or just like in general, like of the conversation around
Yeah, it
that.
Doesn't need to be in specific relation to the things that we've talked about so far. Although it'd be great if it was, but if you had any initial responses to the questions that we asked on the worksheet too, what your thoughts are on what's left of the self, the end of the world, we would love to hear that. I think you look like you want to say something, so prepare for the yarn.
I have like two main thoughts, I think, and let me know if I need to like speak any louder. I think that the one thing that kind of relates back to what you were saying and like thinking about what's left of like the autonomous self is kind of like it leads me to think about like trauma-informed parts work, which is this idea that like there are different parts of self, and like I think that working through that can be really difficult, because in a general understanding of self it's like you are unified, but I think for a lot of people they actually have, you know, those two brains or those multiple brains or like different parts of themselves talking to each other or saying like, yes, you should go for this, and no, you absolutely shouldn't. And like the fact that that is very common but not really digestible, I think was really like, it was really connecting with me to what you were talking about of the assembly of things. And I think that not only applies to things but also us as well. And I mean, there are pitfalls of that work and it can be like dangerous and scary, but here. And then the other thing was talking about consent in like in revolution, and I'm really interested in that conversation about like seduction. And I think for me it connects back to like the pitfalls of consensus-based decision making, which is when consensus-based decision making actually becomes like anti-consensus, because it's one person who is putting up that I'm not comfortable with this, and rather than the group moving forward, they stop, and it ends up often being those in power who are putting their foot down for that progress, even in like mutual aid groups or like other communities where we tend to be a little bit more informed and want that consensus-based decision making. It falls back onto those with the most power who are still like putting a stop to it. And I thought that really connects to like what consent looks like and what it looks like towards like any change we want to see.
It's okay. As much as you can.
Really amping it up here.
Well done.
These thoughts aren't really worked out, so please bear with me if it's a little disorganized, but I was really interested in what you were saying about the forest self, and especially the idea of consent and non-consent as establishing the self. And I've been thinking a lot recently about images and how images directly, unconsciously shift our self-perceptions and the way that we like perceive the world. And I wonder if the self is this like porous kind of thing, that being immersed in like these digital environments that we're in, where we're just saturated with these images, if that removes agency in constructing the self, or if in building revolutionary subjectivity in the now, we have to consent to, or at least try to create very specific environments of what we're intaking in order to not have the self be constructed within like a liberal framework that's already going to be self-defeating. And I was wondering if anyone has ideas or suggestions, not so much for like getting fully out of the digital environment, because I don't think we can, or like that we can fully avoid intaking images, but for kind of constructing these radical subjectivities under these conditions, and if, I don't know, curating your environments and trying to connect more directly with the world around us, if that can be constitutive of a more radical subjectivity. I don't know if that made any sense.
Yeah, same intro. This is all just in my head, so apologies. But to me, it's like a fundamental truth in my mind that like this is not, is not me, and like we are not one self. We are all connected. Like that just in my brain is like obviously, right? But I don't have an answer to your question in terms of how. Like, well, I guess I maybe do, just kind of going back to the way the world used to work, the old ways, if you will, like working with nature and living close to nature and close to those around us. And I think it's extremely important that, like, instead of, you know, capitalism and other such things kind of lead us to be, you know, oneself and apart from everybody else, and, like, if you believe something different, then you're crazy and weird. You know, if you believe that the world has, that the earth has a heartbeat or something, you're like this crazy kook, and then it just is very divisive and leads to a lot of hate. And I think building communities of like-minded people that, you know, because it seems so radical to live our lives in this way, just like going into the woods and living off the land and, you know, like homeschooling your children and all that, but like it's they want us to think that that's radical so that it doesn't happen and no change actually is affected. So I think just like creating these communities and, you know, doing your thing is good. So, yeah.
I mean, I expect that. So yeah, it's really talking to me too. We have been like in conversation with some of my friends around this question of like the influence of algorithm on consciousness and on our capacity to build like worldview. Because you know, like algorithms has been really centered of like our daily life, especially during pandemic, I feel, and that we want it or not, like we're so influenced by communication, and communication being online on platform that we don't own and that actually want to own us is, yeah, pretty destructive. Yeah, it's hard, like working in like a nonprofit that is using like social media as if it was like the reaching goal of the world and how we can build everyone's understanding of the world through that is kind of like for me really absurd, and like using this as an end or like a mean to reach people for me is like really weird. And yeah, like I don't know, I would just say that yeah, it's for me, it's not, there's also like not a definitive thing, but like kind of going out of this for me, like going back to mailing lists and going back to like other ways of communication that are like structured but not by fucking shit that we don't control at all, like yeah, it's kind of a thing. And then it comes to, like, also back to consent, right? Like, how we're receiving emails is decided on, like, also algorithm around spamming, but also around what, how much emails we want to have. And, like, it's come back to, like, our capacity to read messages and, like, look at things and diffuse them. Like, just looking at Facebook and scrolling forever, like, it's, it can be a good cope for a certain, and, like, I do that sometimes, you know, like, scrolling forever, but, like, it's a doom scrolling in a certain way, yeah, and it's working with algorithm that, personally, sometimes I, like, fucking hate, so, anyway, so that's, yeah.
You're gonna be the last comment, so that we can then open it up for two more times. That was really good. Yeah, and just thinking about that, I feel like with kind of bringing in more like algorithm and technology stuff, I think that's sort of the thing is where, you know, it's this really fast-paced mode of consumption and it's getting faster and faster. But the modes of violence that are happening at the end of the world are really slow. And even though it feels like, oh, well, 11 years till the, you know, climate destruction doesn't feel that slow, on a day-to-day level, like, the violence is slower than I think that we can understand or detect or even perceive as necessarily violent, you know? I feel like, I mean, this is like Rob Nixon's slow violence, but it's like where we understand violence as these kind of explosive moments in space and time, but what is really happening at the end, like apocalypse, is a slow decay and a slow decline. And I think that that's like where things can get tricky, as you're saying, kind of like being online. How do we like be able to like stay with trouble of the violence, you know? And I think what garbage really kind of articulates super well too, and why I really like it as part of this altar, is that, I don't know, I feel like when I first learned it, or like gaining consciousness about like climate justice, like garbage really scared me, because I feel like it was just this like horrible, icky, disgusting thing that was a part of what was destroying the world, you know?
it physically, I pretty assure this book is Emergent Theory, Emergent Strategy, sorry, from Adrienne Mary Brown. For those who don't know, I'm gonna just say, like, we didn't really talk about authors, but I think it's useful to still, like, just say who people are. And so, yeah, Adrienne is, like, an author from the United States. She's 43 and writes either fiction and nonfiction. A lot of, like, she's really prolific and has been writing around, like, Emergent Strategy, a book called We Will Not Cancel Us, and a lot of, like, different perspectives that kind of, like, merge a lot, so it's, like, really interesting on how she's working, you know, like, theory behind that. And I'm gonna focus, obviously, on, like, Emergent Strategies right now, for some reason. But so, from this idea, I had brought some question, which was kind of, like, how the self can happen to the end of the world, but also how to make place to the end of the world in oneself. How can we prefigure and imagine without becoming one with, like, how is this relationship grows, and how to move in our struggle without being static or forcing oppression or getting up close up, etc. So I don't know if we've been, like, it's not a thing we discussed necessarily in the discussion group, but, like, I don't know if you're, like, familiar with, like, a prefigurative, like, conception of anarchism, which has this idea of, like, bringing in the really small level what we want to create collectively. So if we don't want to have hierarchy in a society, we're going to start by having collective that have not. Adrienne Mary Brown kind of, like, bring this idea, but kind of in a different way, because it's also a nature perspective that anarchists didn't really have necessarily in all of their texts. She talks about Octavia Butler as, like, her main, like, figure of reading that. So a lot of, like, about, like, writers of Afrofuturist revolutionaries and working about fiction, but, like, fiction as science fiction, and that's kind of, like, the relationship which she's kind of building in between science and science fiction as kind of a tool to grow practices. And even if we're, like, not really a focused practice group, and we're pretty, I don't know if we're useless, but we're pretty, not really in the practical.
We're just pretty.
We have been, like, still, like, the notion of, like, anxiety around the end of the world, and, or, like, what is that, what's happening, and what happens to ourselves thinking about it, but also being part of it, has been kind of a thing that has been growing. So, working with, like, Adrienne Mary Brown was kind of interesting. In the notes and quotes that I brought, she brings some ideas. It's mostly from the introduction, but she has different ways of thinking, like, her work, but also, like, just radical work. And what is Emergent Strategy is just this idea that on a really small level, you inform others' world in a fractal way. So it's not just this, prefigurative way that is, like, we're going to decimate or we're going to bring contagious agent to other people by being, like, I don't know, throwing a brick, people are going to throw bricks after, like, that's nice. But also the idea of a fractal, which is kind of like if you change an element of a group or a system, the system change itself, and on different level, on the level that happens, but on the smaller level too, and on the bigger level too. Like, that's the idea of a fractal. She has a really strong conception that brings collective power and centering, like, again, like, black power, like we said a bit earlier. Like, her work is really centering, like, how to bring black liberation, but also is really magic oriented, so bringing an intention practice into our daily life, and kind of, like, having an idea that nature is not a competition, it's not, as we've been taught, like, just things and animals and plants that compete each other onto what we, like, see, but also they're there to be in a community of beings that kind of needs to be together to be surviving, actually. And that's, like, a common trend that has been going on in so many, like, contemporary books. I found that I've been bringing that more and more as an emphasis, being like let's stop being into this narrative that is just not true, actually.
actually, nature shows us the opposite. So let's move out from that. And so these thoughts that I'm not going to read right now are really like saying, like, you know, the crisis is everywhere, massive, and we're small, but like emergent strategies is kind of a way to bridge that on a small scale, and then creating complex systems that are really hard to disrupt, because it's not just like an organization thing. It's, well, I mean, yeah, it's organization on a really organic way, creating situation of disruption, and also magical practice. Of, for me, like, that's where like my chaos practice is, like, I want to create situation where like self-power and collective like process of healing or individual process of healing can appear, and so bring these little moments of chaos can bring at the end more possibilities than just if I was like trying to, I don't know, do the best thing that I think, but what is? So yeah, I mean, I could go for more than that on probably like magic practices that I love, but yeah, I'm just gonna open now to give back the ball to Ty, who's gonna continue after this.
Oh.
Object is already on the altar. It is the painting of the portal right there. Yeah, so mine is going to be a little bit more out there, but I don't know, it's kind of just like how I'm conceiving and wanting to theorize the end of the world. The question is, the end of the world in itself is a portal. How do we utilize this liminal space to acknowledge the loss of timeline and aim towards other possibilities of being in the world? Oh my god. Okay. In one of the weeks, we discussed Donna Haraway's book, Staying with the Trouble, and specifically the Camille stories, Children of Compost. This is a speculative fabulation that Haraway imagines of a proximate future and the increasing erosion of the world and communities that live in capitalist ruins. So in this story, she talks about these communities of compost, and like compost, they are liminal in every way. There are these symbionts who are crucial members of this community who at birth come into being with an animal of a migratory species. And in this speculative world, genes are mixed from the animal to the human child, although the animal partners are not modified. So they're kind of coming into being with the sense of a fracturedness of humanness and both being a combination of human and animal. So throughout this chapter, Haraway returns again and again to the notion of the corridor, mentioning that for the communities of compost, corridors are essential to their being. They are being in between space, both physically as migratory species and ontologically. And I feel like it kind of struck me, especially when I heard this repetition of the corridor throughout this chapter, where I sort of realized I was like, corridors and the portal is kind of operating in the same way. So the question I'm asking operates from the notion of the portal. And this is partially inspired by Arundhati Roy's article, The Pandemic is a Portal, in which I'm going to quote a small passage from the article that'll be on your worksheet. Whatever it is, coronavirus has made the mighty kneel and brought the world to a halt like nothing else could. Our minds are still racing back and forth, longing for a return to our normality, trying to stitch our future to our past and refusing to acknowledge the rupture. But the rupture exists. And in the midst of this terrible despair, it offers us a chance to rethink the doomsday machine we have built for ourselves. Nothing could be worse than a return to normality. Historically, pandemics have forced humans to break with the past and imagine their world anew. This one is no different. It is a portal, a gateway between one world and the next. So, although I understand the importance of acknowledging rupture that colonization and capitalism have done, something that in a way is irreversible, there's no coming back from it, and there's no return. We can't recover old timelines that have been violently disrupted.
disrupted and eroded. However, I kind of want to bring this back to Haraway and imagine the portal at the end as having a different relationship to the past than just a break. And so I'll continue. Like a corridor, the portal is a liminal space, a space between spaces. Even in itself, it is the void. In the void, there's a multiplicity of timelines, not just the timelines that were, but two, the timelines that have been foreclosed, and the possibilities and futures those timelines never got to fulfill. Like compost, the portal I'm theorizing kind of exists in this in-between state, both an ending and a beginning, in living and dying, and what is transformed and birthed from decomposition. And I think using compost the way that Haraway does is really salient, because it kind of brings us back to this point where this right here at the end is also this point of transformation at a beginning. And in the damage and decomposition and staying with the trouble of compost and decomposing of this world, there is where we can move through the portal to a new one. To enter the portal is sort of to enter into the nothingness, as a few folks have been discussing. But two, it is to enter into everything, all timelines, infinite possibilities. The portal is where we take stock, where we acknowledge the loss, and where we stay with the trouble. And so I'm going to say one more quote from Haraway that I really liked, and I think that it kind of articulates how we can, I guess, be within the trouble of damage and decay at the end. The communities of compost worked and played hard to understand how to inherit the layers upon layers of living and dying that infuse every place and every corridor. Unlike inhabitants in many other utopian movements, stories, or literatures in the history of the earth, the children of compost knew they could not deceive themselves if they could start from scratch. Precisely the opposite insight moved them. They asked and responded to the question of how to live in the ruins that were still inhabited with ghosts and the living too. And there's another quote underneath it that kind of talks about similar things.
What? Damn.
But yeah, I guess basically kind of what I'm moving from here is these kind of two things here at the end that I feel like are true. First of all, that there's no way to start over or begin anew. And second of all, there's no way to go back. We must move through the portal to other worlds. And I don't think it's so much as like we need to form the portal. I think the end in itself, like compost, is a portal in itself, you know? It is fundamentally this opening and this chance that lives in decay. But I feel what our responsibility is collectively is not creating the portal, but knowing how to aim it. And I think that that's kind of where the portal kind of exists as like generative space that I've been theorizing on. How do we aim portals, you know? And the end is just this mix of infinite possibilities that exist within the damage, you know? And where are we aiming and creating intention to move from here?
Okay, so that is everyone from our reading group that's spoken about the text. And now we want to open up the floor to talk about the specific two texts that have just been spoken about, but also more of a generative conversation about kind of synthesizing everything together. So again, in response to the quotes that we have, your own interpretation of what is left of the self at the end of the world.
It also just can go in any direction.
Just wanted to highlight the relations between the Haraway reading and the Bennett reading, because I think we've talked a lot about how these two texts are connected. And just the importance of becoming with the non-human in a responsible way, not just in the Haraway text, you become with specifically animals that are extinct or about to go extinct or something like that. Camille is merged with a monarch butterfly, I think it was. I don't remember if there were others as well. But yeah, pretty much these like cute, very cute animals that we were, well, they're very cute, that we're scared of going extinct.
but it is more than just that. We haven't discussed it today, but we've also discussed in our own group a book called Pollution is Colonialism by Max Liebl-Iron, I think is how their last name is pronounced. I'm very proud of French. But something that they write about in their text is how we, in the social sciences and humanities, we have this tendency to put this picture of a decaying albatross in the board full of plastic and be like, look, we need to save it, we need to be more responsible, we need to aim the portal or aim the end of the world in a better way so we can save this albatross. So what are we doing? Look at what we've done. And Max says it's very rude because, first of all, why would you put, and it also it's under the presumption that we need to make kin with the albatross in order to save it, and this is how we move responsibly through to the end. And Max says this is very irresponsible because, first of all, why would you put a picture of your dying or dead kin on the board? Strange. But also in the sense that they presume kinship without being chosen to that kinship, and do so selectively. We're almost always talking about the albatross and never the plastic inside the albatross. But what about that? Shouldn't plastic be part of our kin as well, even though that might be a more complicated relationship? So these are conversations we've had in relation to the two texts, thinking about what is in our compost pile and how we kind of transform and move through portals and with whom. Not gonna go very far.
Oh,
less of a ball and more of a.
That's
a light bulb.
There we go.
So just really briefly on that note, something else that I wanted to say earlier but I forgot. So Nora brought another text that we haven't talked about. It's called "Story for a Bottle" by Little Badger. It's a really interesting text. Something that stuck out in the introduction was the idea that we have already reached the end of the world and now we are just in the dystopian reality of that. And so when we think about the colonial violence that many communities are already faced, are facing, and a continuation of that, that is kind of a way to reinterpret it. And I think that also bodes well for some sort of optimism that Ty was talking about in the sense of like there being infinite timelines. So if you rephrase it from sort of like with your capitalist model of us just continuing and instead having this like openness of time and community, I think that is also like a very nice way to think about it. Thank you.
One thing about that, like this indigenous queer book is called Love After the End. I really, really highly recommend it. It's like basically on the team too. No, it came out last year and it's obviously not easy to find just pirating, and also I suggest to buy it. It's like really good to buy books from like indigenous queer author, it's mostly from so-called Canada, but it's really, really interesting, and I have a lot of diversity on what could happen, and it's like brings this idea of future, I think that's kind of the thing too, like where and how we center self or things, and who are we centering, is like, you know, it's a basic conversation that we should always have in like rich call circles, but still need to be addressed, I think, here. Having this position of like indigenous queer bringing an idea of how future could look at the end of the world is extremely powerful, and so that's just what I want to say.
Can you repeat the name of the book?
Love After the End. It's a Whitehead, Joshua Whitehead, who edited the book, but it's like I think 15 different authors, so it's also a really good moment to like discover Canadian, or like, well, not Canadian, but indigenous queer from like different nation. I think there's like at least 5 or 6 different nations who are included, so yeah.
Thank you.
You want the ball?
Oh my gosh.
Okay, this is falling apart.
This is what it is now.
Similarly to what other people said, like, my thoughts are still kind of forming, so yeah, bear with me. But I think that, okay, what I'm going to say is related primarily to what Hannah and Ty just said. So yeah, one thing that I've been thinking about as this had all been going is, because I guess partly because I missed the introduction, I didn't hear how people were describing the end of the world, but yeah, something that had been occurring to me is just that, like, for a lot of people, the world has already, like, ended, like, their world has already ended, like, obviously, the best example is right here, like, an entire, like, continent of nations was, like, almost entirely wiped out. That whole culture, like, not entirely, obviously, that, like, lots of nations, like, yeah, they all still, like, many still exist and have, like, vibrant communities. But yeah, just that fact that, like, capitalism, especially from its very beginning, brought the end of the world to people, like capitalism and colonialism. So understanding how, for many people here, the end of the world is only just happening now is actually very important, because that already sets us at a different position, like, in terms of ourselves, like ourselves as individuals, and also our self-interest. Like, until, for example, the climate crisis arrived, many people did not have an interest in thinking about capitalism. Like, they didn't have to care about capitalism, because as far as their self-interest were concerned, capitalism was fine for them. Because of the climate crisis, things are just not really the same. But that's always been an issue for people since the beginning of capitalism and colonialism, and even before. So the way that it relates to what Ty was saying is, so on the one hand, capitalism has already brought the end of the world to so many people, and requires people to be like impoverished, exploited, brutalized, oppressed, and so on. But on the other hand, just like Ty was saying, there are, at every moment in the development of capitalism and the development of the whole, like, oppressive social order that we live in, there are opportunities to overcome it, the opportunities to change it. And yeah, there have been obviously many, many, many missed possibilities. Chances that we could, as humanity, as human beings, as anti-capitalists, as anti-people, like, interested in anti-oppression as a whole, there have been many opportunities where it could have been more or less possible to overcome the whole capitalist social order and everything that goes along with it. And to different extents, that has happened. Like, we have achieved certain, like, some gains in some ways. Like, in some ways. Like, highly qualified, but yeah, some things have happened that have been the basis of successive, the success of which has been on the basis of grassroots movements, like this has happened. So where we are right now is, yes, one type of end of the world, but it is also the potential beginning of a new world, which is what I would say, I think. And whether it is the beginning of a new world depends on what we do right now. Like, whatever, like, the way that what Ty was saying about a portal really just reminded me of, or the way that I was kind of interpreting the portal is the portal as just being the, like, all of the possible futures that exist. All of the possible futures that exist, that exist depend on, like, the outcome of the future depends on what we do right now in the present. And therefore it really, really matters what we do right now in the present to address this ongoing end of the world that has existed for hundreds of years, if not, like, and actually much longer. Then just kind of maybe one of the last things is, I mentioned a bit earlier but I think is really important in talking about the self, to talk about self-interest, because and this goes back to what was said earlier, what you were saying about like the self also being a porous thing. It's like we don't only have self-interest, and we are not constituted only by ourselves, we're constituted by everyone around us, and that's how we even come to identify as a self. But the point, basically where I'm getting at that is, yeah, like we don't only have self-interest, we have many like other like interests that concern other people, but we do also have self-interest, and it's partly to do with our self-interest, or it's very much to do with our self-interest, how we interact with the prospect of like a total global end of the world. And basically what I'm ultimately getting at is that this, like, considering what is left of the self at the end of the world requires us to look, yeah, beyond, like, so much more beyond our self as an individual and our individual self-interest, because the only way that we're going to be able to move out of, like, the very worst of the prospects that face us as different portals is by acting collectively. And in terms of a revolutionary subjectivity, which I think one of you were mentioning earlier, I think that a revolutionary subjectivity really, really needs to situate itself within the interests of like humanity, like, and the environment as a whole, not just the individuals that we all are being part, obviously, of a community. So that was the main point that I wanted to make. And also just to be clear, I did share with Hannah that paper, The Policy of Socialism. I don't believe in it, like, I don't agree with it. Like, I don't believe in the kind of reformist, it is effectively a reformist, article. I don't agree with it, just to be clear.
It is an interesting text to explore kind of
stuff. Yeah, it's worth.
We bashed Domitsky pretty hard that week. We bashed him pretty hard that week. But fun to bash, interesting to bash.
Yeah, there's many things you said that I really like. First of all, yes, like, I think our fundamental notion too, that's why I said capital W world, is that for the capital W capitalist world to be created, many worlds already had to be destroyed, you know? That is just what world making is built so much, not just around, you know, collective action, but also time, you know, and all these different things. And so I feel like many ends of the world have already happened, and for this world to be created, endings upon ending had to, and timelines specifically, had to be violently disrupted. And I think that too, like, kind of when I talk about this portal too, and you talked about how, like, there have been a lot of movements that have kind of gotten close to whatever, like, revolution or all of these different things. I think in the portal too, when I'm talking about infinite timelines, like, I'm talking about too the timelines that, you know, could have been but never were, you know? And thinking about even, like, very, like, personally, thinking about the way that, like, colonial legacy, like, exists within your ancestry and stuff like that, it's also so important for me to understand, like, all the possibilities that could have been, you know, within, if, like, colonialism hadn't happened or whatever. And I think within the portal, I'm asking for us to meet all of that too, you know, all of what could have been, you know. And finally, when you were kind of talking about saying it is about, is about what we're doing right now to aim the portal, I would also emphasize it is also who we are being. And I think that that's why it's so important to return to the self. And I think that, like, this is more talking about more, like, magic-y stuff, but I do a lot of, like, timeline-shifting stuff. And in timeline-shifting, on a personal level, to enter, like, whatever timeline that you want to enter is to have to embody the self that is on that timeline. And so I think, I guess I'm kind of just theorizing myself on this, like, really big collective scale, It is too about like what we're doing during this time to aim, but also about who we're being. Like, what is the self that is going to be on this in this new world? You know, what does the self look like on this new timeline and stuff like that? And so I think that that is also like a part of the aiming process. It is embodying the new world, not only as an idea, but like in yourself, you know? And I think that that's super important, you know, to ground ourselves in. Because we also see all the ways that all these revolutionary movements kind of justify, you know, act as if the end can justify the means, that who they're being in the moment, which is maybe cruel, unjust, whatever, all of these different things could justify this utopian world that they're aiming for. But I think the point that we're trying to emphasize, it is who we're being now, you know, it is who we're acting in radical love and in care of our communities, acting justly towards each other and building, you know, collective like networks of care that is also part of this building new world. And it doesn't look like grand, you know, in some ways. But I think as like the kind of fractal thing that you were talking about, Dora, like it is also like these small things and movements that create these kind of like rippling, fractaling effects, you know, which is a part of like emergent strategies, obviously.
Personally, I've had to like undo a lot of my own thinking that, okay, we need to just like, we're going in the wrong direction, we need to backtrack. There's no such thing out here. And I feel like it's a lot of wasted energy. So looking back is good, but walking backwards just never works. So I think I wonder like, kind of like similarly to personal growth, there's like ups and downs. Maybe we have these things in terms of like social growth as well. Our ideas grow. We do better sometimes and we do worse at other times. And somehow like the only like I always wonder like maybe even capitalism is a necessary step. really unfortunate step, but a necessary one. And the only thing that, like, my like biggest guiding principle is like no unnecessary pain and no like lives lost. Like that's the biggest like guiding principle that I have. So, and I guess that brings me to the third point that I found really interesting was like the end of the world. I think that I find it, I don't know if like it's used with that intent, but I think it's really important to mourn the people that like we've lost, but it's also really important to like not forget that, for example, for the indigenous communities, like yes, a version of their world has ended, but there's real people still alive, like trying to like keep culture alive. So like the world is always becoming something. It's never like completely ended, because if there are still people, if there's still a culture there, like it's very much in need of like resources and like giving. So I like to think of the end of the world as like not something to despair over, but like something to just always watch out for. And maybe always in terms of like lives lost and like needless pain. So that's what I, yeah, thought of. Oh yeah, sure.
I was thinking a lot about the bit on consent earlier, because like having not read most of these texts, I had also recently like written a piece that was basically like, yeah, consent, actually maybe this is kind of limiting what we can dream of as being possible. So it feels like really wild to be like, oh, that's everyone else is here too, cool. And thinking about that also in terms of like this phrase of aiming the portal and then the size of the world. Like if you're aiming the portal, if you're trying to create something new, if everyone is like, act now, we need to do something right now, who are we asking that for? Like, are we intentionally violating people's consent in the world that we want to create? Because we think that's necessary, we think that's good, and we think that's a valuable thing to do. I don't know. It feels like for some reason it's like I don't feel like I have to give consent, but I also want it from other people. And then I want to hear more on that thought of like the self created through trauma is like then aiming the portal, creating something new, creating something without consent. Like, is that a traumatic act that forces other people to have a new self? And is that desirable? Is that what's wanted? And to me, I think the world just has the self. And the world just feels like the world has to be so much smaller in order for this to feel possible or good to me, I guess. Yeah. I don't think this is gonna get thrown.
I'll get it. Thank you. Just to briefly respond to that, and I think we're gonna try to wrap it up a little bit soon, given that our time for our presentation has elapsed. So her notion of consent or of trauma, I mean, is like more totalizing than I think like what our like contemporary notion of trauma is, or like non-psychoanalytic notion of trauma, that everything is essentially trauma, everything that constitutes a self, everything, well, the self being like constituted of all the objects around it, essentially, and being distinct from those objects. It's a lot more of like a woo-woo notion of trauma and of self and worldness than like our contemporary sort of like common sense version of that. But I think essentially the idea of like the trauma that will create the new world is not really a trauma in the sense that we like conceive of it now, of like that it will be this like horrible event that you'll have like PTSD about, and that it's like, you know, like cynical or bad in that sort of sense, but that it like, and that this portal sort of like enters us all into something that has, that forces everyone to create themselves in a new way. Like there is this newness, and the newness recognizes that like it's built on death, essentially, and this is like what we've been engaging with, is that like
in order to exist, there has to be things that are excluded, there have to be things outside of, and it's engaging with that and recognizing it, and despite that, moving through the portal and like reconstituting, and that not everyone's going to be on board with it, but that it's so generative and so like massive and large and necessary that it will happen, I suppose.
Yeah, also like the thing of prime thing, which was interesting, it's like there's like the personal level of consent and there's like a political consent, and if you come from a like place of like shared values and you yeah, it's like it's not going against like shared values that are kind of like under the edge, and like also thinking of like harm reduction and like different things. So the text is going a bit further. It's also weird because the text is also really based on like, oh yeah, consent, it's like not that great, but at the same time like desire is really great, and all the text is like based so that people are like drawn to this theory. So it's, you know, it's a kind of a circle. It's not a really good theory in itself, but sometimes like anarchist propaganda is like that. So so yeah, I don't think we handed like a really proper end on that. But yeah, another thing I wanted to say around this idea, like coming back to like how imposed on this territory people have been, destroying their land and destroying like their practice and like culture and like killed basically. Like the, I don't know if you've been like working with like the drunk, like saw like the people talking about the doctrine of discovery, and how it's like important and impactful. Like I think that's kind of an example of like bad portal opening by the Pope and their friends, basically being like, yeah, you can go and destroy everything, you know. And that's an example of like portal opening that could be like not that's it, and it shows like dynamic of power, right? So for me, it's like how we're like breaking like portals is also how we're breaking dynamics of power, and like how we're sharing and like building things that are not necessarily based on like personal needs, but other things than ourselves.
Yeah, okay. Not to interrupt conversation, but I think that maybe we'll transition to, if people still have more thoughts and want to talk, please feel free to do that in this space, but we're going to maybe conclude as a group. It is really hot and there's other workshops and great things happening today. If you're interested in joining us, we haven't really talked about what the next step is for our reading group, but if you want to be a part of that, come talk to us. We have a QR code with all of the text that we talked about today if you're interested, and we would love to talk to you more. Thank you so, so much for joining us today and having this conversation. It was so lovely to meet everyone and see everyone. And thank you for making our own portal.
Yeah. Yeah. Does anyone want the QR code to the library? Yeah.
We also.
Oh, also, I want to take some photos of me.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I feel like it's so happy.
Yeah. Oh, I can show the QR code, and then you can.
Yeah. No idea.
Thinking and crazy. I'm going to take some photos of things. Sorry. But also, does anyone want the QR code? I can.
Yes.
Please be careful of the string.
There's like a reading list.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And I suggested reading list, some supplemental stuff, and then a bunch of files with text that we read.
We can add that to the document, which is very vital information that I didn't think about.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for showing me.
Please let me know if there's any issues.
Yeah. We should put our contact in the document.
Yeah. We like really are really not on the ether. We just have this giant Instagram chat. So like, as we do have people in there. Thank you so much.
We're gonna figure something out to
come
out
of it.
Like existing.
We're like, oh, it's gonna be us and two friends. That's fine. No, much bigger turnout.
Yeah.
We're trying to make this
very much like a choose your own adventure vibe of like storytelling thing.
because we're like, this was an early sort of reading group. But we all have using the same words.
Right.
So Twine is very well suited to the fact that each pipe can have siblings to other pages.
A lot of us
like, and then you know, like, a document.
And I think I'm very curious about
each
pretend we are going to come to know how to make it more, but it's very I'm doing how, like, this is the part of this, right? This is like, how do we do this? How like, do we do
this? We're like, that's like our life. Like,
people are in
towards, like,
the
video text, and towards this presentation.
Because, like, and then, like, I don't like to hear facts.
I don't know my
picking text based on
what they
want
you
to and kind of pondering it.
But they're all still like
peripheral,
so we said
just
like
hostess
dinner that was so
and
famed.
I miss you
so
very nice.
I saw this
like,
weird thing
on
Diva
with
your
kind of
husband.
Yeah. I was so excited, I was like, are you on the
phone?
And it's evolved
into this. There's
so many
friends. Well, we were meeting there. You meet there every week. But they just have a backyard
and everything.
Like, very,
I read it to a vlog over this, and we were like, wait a minute.
Cigarette butts and broken glass.
Yeah.
So we cleaned out of the vlog and did a bunch of
cool
friends. And then, like, 2 days
that
we're getting
for that. And I think that was also one thing we talked about when we were talking with the workshop. Oh, well, we should have a thesis that we present to the group. And then realized we don't have one, and we probably don't need one, because why don't we have the answer to the huge question that we're chewing on?
Oh my god, I
think
that word.
Yeah, that would be pretty phenomenal.
Like,
so this is what we did
in
this, basically.
We were just like,
and our current selves and our current collective selves limit that action, right?
Not to go
to make sure that you're thriving. I'm not sure if anyone here did
get it.
That one's probably the Eric and Buckner one. Wait, is it
public? Yeah. No worries.
Oh, I just realized I've been recording this whole time.
I don't know.
Oh, no. I don't know.